We continue the journey through God's Word. Let's begin with that 30,000-foot overview of this section. Now, the entire United Kingdom period is a period of 120 years. Saul, David, and Solomon each reigning for 40 years apiece. And so just kind of maybe some of the major bullet points of the overview. This is the beginning of what we call the United Kingdom time period, a time that we often romanticize in the way that we talk about it, as though the United Kingdom was the glory days of the nation of Israel, that they were all united together, the north and the south. It was before there was any inner turmoil or problems or conflict or anything like that. And we think of the United Kingdom as like that was the best time in the nation of Israel. And yet, as you've gone through your readings, you realize, no, that's not exactly the case. Though there were a lot of good things that happened, this was far from a time of peace and tranquility or perfection. It was fraught with turmoil and infighting and idolatry and failure after failure after failure of God's people. And so it began at the behest, this period begins at the behest of the people when they go to Samuel and say, we don't want you to judge us anymore. We want to have a king like all the rest of the nations. And so, even though that's not really what God desires for his people, he allows them to have what they want. And they are given an earthly king to rule over them. And though Saul's reign begins with some promise and potential, he quickly proves to be exactly what the people asked for. A king like all the rest of the nations around them. One who does not fear God and one who looks to himself alone. And ultimately, that leads then to his family and what could have been a dynasty in his name being replaced by that of the family of David. And so we saw in our readings the history of David from his anointing at a young age to his early victories and his rise among the ranks in Saul's army and then in Saul's household, and then how he became Saul's enemy and had to flee from the presence of Saul, who basically spent the latter part of his reign hunting David like a fugitive. And we'll talk about some of that this morning. And we see with the establishment of the Davidic dynasty and God's promises to David that God is going to give him a son one day who God will call his own son, who will build a temple, who will sit on his throne forever. Now that was partially realized in David's son Solomon, even from the aspect of sitting on the throne and building a temple. But ultimately that's a messianic promise. Because that seed of David, the son of David, who would ultimately come, who would sit on his throne forever and would build the new temple, which, by the way, you and I are living stones in today, was the King Jesus Christ. And so that's the thread that goes through this section. Now, as we dig a little bit deeper into some of the history that's going on here, and so I think what's best to do is try to lay out here at the beginning some key dates and some chronological markers for some of the main characters that we're going to talk about in this section, and then we'll go back and we'll fill in some of the blanks throughout those to give it a little bit more depth. And so, as we said, this is the period that we refer to as the United Kingdom from 1050 to 930 BC, a period of about 120 years. And that's broken up into three equal parts, 40 years apiece for Saul, David, and Solomon, each sitting on the throne and reigning as king over the nation of Israel. Now, Saul, when we zoom in here just a little bit, we see that Saul begins his reign in 1050 BC. That would have been about 5 years after the death of Samson and that great victory that Samuel won over the Philistines at Mizpah, where, remember, he raised the stone, the rock of help, the Ebenezer. And it was only shortly after that then that Israel said, we don't want you to lead us, we want a king like the rest of the nations. And so in 1050, 5 years or so after those events, Saul is appointed as the nation's first king. Let me ask you this question real quick. How many of you, when you read the story of Saul, especially at the beginning, picture a young man being chosen from his family and made king over the nation of Israel. A relatively young guy, Saul. That's how I always read it. The characteristics of him, his timidity, his hiding among the baggage, even him being sent on this errand by his father to find the donkeys and stuff like that, along with a servant, I always pictured it as a young man. But would you be surprised to know that Saul, when he ascended to the throne, when he was appointed king, he was probably at least in his mid-30s. He may have been my age, close to 40. The reality is that we know for a certainty that he had at least three sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, who had to have been born before he became king, because the year that he becomes king, his fourth son, Ishbosheth, is born. And as you read through the narrative, you realize that at least Jonathan, his eldest son, takes a very prominent role, not just within the family of Saul, but within his war cabinet, leading the armies of Israel in the early days of Saul's reign, which means that Saul was not some young, single guy when he was appointed king. He was a middle-aged man, had a family of his own, a wife, and at least three boys, the oldest of which was probably well into his mid to late teens at the beginning of Saul's reign. And so some of those things maybe put the story a little bit more in context when we think about how we picture these characters that are described to us in the biblical narrative. Something else that's interesting to me is that when we start shifting to thinking about David, because there's going to be a lot of overlap between Saul and David and their two stories, did you realize that David is not born until the 10th year of Saul's reign? So David is born in 1040 BC after Saul's already been reigning over the nation of Israel for a solid 10 years. Now that's interesting to me because if you remember from the reading, David and Saul's oldest son Jonathan become really close friends. And how many of you pictured as you read the narrative of two peers, the same age, running around together and doing things together and just having this great kinship and connection? I always thought of them as being the same age. And yet the reality is that Jonathan is probably 25 years older, at least, than David. Maybe as much as 30 years older than David. And yet they form a very close bond and relationship with one another. Now, it'll be probably another 15 years after that when David is anointed as the next king. So we're 25 years into the reign of Saul when David is anointed by Samuel as the next king, because he's still a youth, maybe about mid-teens. I put him at 15 years old here being anointed. It'll be another 2 to 5 years before he fights against the giant Goliath and is put into Saul's war cabinet and ultimately becomes a son-in-law to the king. And so the reality is when we think about that time span, we think Saul was on the throne for 40 years. Much of what we know of his story actually takes place only within the last about 10 to 15 years of his reign. So I just want to put some of those things in perspective for you as you think about how all of these pieces fit together. So let's zoom in here and let's look at filling in some of the blanks here, particularly in the reign of Saul, that would help to explain why Israel's first dynasty, which really wasn't a dynasty, failed in its first generation, and how the family of David was chosen by God to become a lasting dynasty. And again, the way that I'm going to do that is not by telling things in a strict chronological order here, or by trying to tell the story, but by pointing to some key events and showing where they fall on this timeline to help us get some perspective of that. And then at the end of the lesson, I want to come back and make an application to us, a lesson we can learn from the life of Saul. So let's go back to the beginning of Saul's reign. Again, he was put on the throne in 1050 BC. And he was somebody who certainly looked the part. He comes from a great pedigree. In 1 Samuel chapter 9, we read in verse 1, "Now there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechorath, the son of Aphiah, the son of a Benjamite, a mighty man of valor." Now, this mighty man of valor is describing not Saul, but Kish, his father. This guy, Kish, verse 2, he had a son whose name was Saul, a choice and handsome man. "And there was not a more handsome person than he among the sons of Israel. From his shoulders and up, he was taller than all the people." So he is a strapping, strong-looking, tall, handsome guy. He looks the part of the king, and he comes from a mighty fighting family. This is the one who God chooses to be the first king for the nation of Israel. But despite his looks, and again, remember, he's not a youth here. He's probably a man in his mid-30s when these events take place. He is timid and hesitant and insecure in himself. When he first meets Samuel and Samuel begins to speak to him all of these wonderful things that are going to happen to him, notice Saul's response in verse 21 of chapter 9. Saul replied, "Am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why didn't you speak to me this way?" He's like, "I'm a nobody. I'm not important. Why are you saying this great stuff is going to happen to me? I'm a nobody from nowhere." That's the way Saul felt about himself. And even as Samuel anoints Saul to be king and then tells him, "As you go on your way home, you're going to see all of these things happen in just such a way." And as Saul goes, he sees all of those things happen in just such a way, confirming that this message was from God. Notice he gets home and he is not very forthcoming with his relatives about what's actually happened on the journey. In 1 Samuel chapter 10 and verse 14, "Now Saul's uncle said to him and his servant, 'Where did you go?' And he said, 'Well, we went to look for the donkeys. And when we saw that they could not be found, we went to Samuel.' Saul's uncle said, 'Well, please tell me what Samuel said to you.' And he said to his uncle, 'He told us plainly that the donkeys had been found.' But that's not all that Samuel had told Saul. In fact, the text tells us he, Saul, did not tell his uncle about the matter of the kingdom, which Samuel has mentioned." It's almost as if Saul is like super reluctant. He doesn't want this job that's being foisted upon him, despite the fact that he looks the part. And in fact, when at Mizpah, Samuel has the ceremony where the lot falls on Saul as the choice for the new king, they can't find him anywhere. Where is he? He's hiding among the baggage. He doesn't want the attention. And yet, despite that, he is made king. The people say to him, as Samuel puts him before them, "Long live the king." And Samuel reminds them of the ordinances of the king and how they're supposed to follow him. But Saul really has done nothing to solidify himself other than look the part as the king of Israel. And that's when God gives him an opportunity. The people of Jabesh-Gilead are oppressed by some Ammonites. And they send for help, and Saul rallies an army and goes and delivers the city of Jabesh-Gilead in a very magnificent fashion. And that kind of solidifies Saul and his position. The people are like behind him now. Yes, he's our king. He'll lead us into battle. We'll follow him wherever he takes us. But that's when things begin to fall apart for Saul. Because Saul, at his root, at his core, is what I would describe as one who is plagued by personal insecurity. And I think that can be characterized best by two events that are recorded for us that illustrate his major failures as a king. The first comes in 1 Samuel chapter 13 and 14, where they're fighting against the Philistines. And Samuel has told Saul, "You need to wait at Gilgal before you go into battle. Wait 7 days. I'll be there. We'll offer a sacrifice to God. And then God will be with you. You can go into battle." And as day 5 is approaching, Samuel hasn't showed up. Day 6 is approaching. Samuel hasn't showed up. The morning of day 7, Samuel still hasn't showed up. And Saul looks around him, and his soldiers and his army are terrified of the Philistines, and they're starting to abandon ship and run away. And so what does Saul do? Well, according to him, he forces himself to offer up the burnt offering to God, something that only the priests were supposed to do. And wouldn't you know it, just as soon as he's done offering the burnt offering, who walks over the hill? Samuel. And Samuel says to him in 1 Samuel chapter 13, and in verse 11 he says, "What have you done?" And Saul says, "Well, because I saw the people were scattering from me, and that you didn't come within the appointed days, and the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, therefore I said, 'Now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not asked the favor of God.' So I forced myself, and I offered the burnt offering." And Samuel said to Saul, "You've acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." And what was the thing that motivated Saul to, in his words, force himself to offer that burnt offering to seek God's favor? Something he was not authorized to do? It was fear. He saw the people were scared, that they were trembling, that they were abandoning the cause. And so because he was motivated by fear, rooted, I believe, in his own personal insecurity, he does something that is against God's will. Now, the same thing happens again some years later when God gives him a mission to go down and utterly destroy the Amalekites. Wipe them all out. Don't leave any breathing thing alive. That's the command. And so what does Saul do? He goes down, verse 7 of 1 Samuel chapter 15. So Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as you go to Shur, which is east of Egypt. He captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were not willing to destroy them utterly, but everything despised and worthless, that they utterly destroyed. And here comes Samuel to check on Saul after this military campaign. And Saul is ecstatic. He runs out to meet Samuel. "I have kept the command of the Lord." And Samuel goes, "Why do I hear all these animals in the camp then?" "Oh, well, you know, we saved them so that you could offer them as sacrifices to your God." "That's not what God told you to do." "Well, the people kind of twisted my arm and they thought it would be a good idea to do that, to offer a sacrifice. So I kind of caved in and listened to the people." And Samuel says to King Saul, "Has the Lord," this is verse 22, "has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is the sin of is as the sin of divination, and insubordination is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king." I would suggest to you that Saul shows a pattern throughout his life that he really doesn't care what God has to say about things. He did what God wanted him to do as long as he thought it was a good idea. He destroyed all the despised and worthless animals. He destroyed all the inhabitants of the land, but he kept the best because he thought that was better than what God said. And again, he tries to blame it on the people made me do it. Well, I'm sorry, but if you're the leader, if you're the king, you're the one who gives the direction. You don't kowtow to the demands and the will of the people. But again, I think Saul did that because personally, he's insecure in his own situation. And it's that insecurity that leads him to question himself, to question God, and ultimately to do things that are contrary to what God has instructed and commanded. And so it was this failures of Saul, as Samuel says here, that led God to rejecting Saul as king. And God sends Samuel in the year 1025 BC to go and anoint David, the son of Jesse, who, by the way, we've already been introduced to Jesse's grandparents, Boaz and Ruth, from last study. They are the grandparents of Jesse, who is the father of the one who God says will be the next king. Pick up with me in 1 Samuel chapter 16. Samuel goes to the house of Jesse in Bethlehem. And notice verse 6. God has told Samuel, one of Jesse's sons is going to be the next king. And so when they entered, that is when Jesse's sons entered, Samuel looked at Eliab, the eldest, and he thought, surely the Lord's anointed is before me. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I've rejected him. That's what they were looking for in Saul, somebody who looked the part. And here's Eliab, and he looks the part. And Samuel thinks, this must be the guy. And God says, no. Don't look at the outward appearance, for God sees not as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And they go through all seven of the eldest sons of Jesse, and none of them are chosen. And so Samuel says, well, are these all your children? And he said, well, there remains yet the youngest. He's tending the sheep. And Samuel said to Jesse, send and bring him for me, for we're not going to sit down until he comes here. And so they sent and brought him in, verse 12. Now he was ruddy with beautiful eyes, a handsome appearance. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for he is the one. And Samuel took the horn of oil, anointed him in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward. And Samuel arose and went to Ramah. Now there's something interesting that happens with the Spirit of the Lord coming mightily upon David here. That Spirit of the Lord had been residing on Saul, but now it leaves Saul to go to David. And Saul begins from that day forward to be tormented by what the text says is an evil spirit. And the only thing that can soothe him is the sound of music. And wouldn't you know it, one of the best musicians in the country is David. And so David is summoned to play the harp for Saul whenever this evil spirit torments him. And Saul initially begins to have quite a bit of love and admiration for David because of the benefit that he is bringing to him. And it's just interesting to me. I like this verse. It's one that I've oftentimes skipped over, verse 18. Then the young men said, behold, I've seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite, who is a skillful musician, a mighty man of valor, a warrior, one prudent in speech and handsome man, and the Lord is with him. You know, I often think of David as this kind of warrior king. But he was more than a warrior. He was a poet. He was a warrior poet. He was a talented musician. Nearly half of the Psalms were written by David. Some of them written even before he ascended to the throne. In fact, the earliest one that we can for sure date happened when he was a son-in-law of Saul, when Saul tries to have him assassinated in his bed. And then he has to flee, and he writes a psalm about that. Psalm 59. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. Though Saul initially loves David, there's a turning point in their relationship. And that happens when David defeats the giant Goliath in 1 Samuel chapter 17. And the reason why their relationship changes is because, well, a couple things. One, all of a sudden now, Jonathan, who is the heir apparent for Saul, becomes close-knit friends with David. In fact, Jonathan begins to show more allegiance to David than he does to his own household. And that's problematic for Saul. But the real thing that gets Saul's goat is that the people begin to admire David more than they admire him. We read in chapter 18 and verse 6, it happened as they were coming when David returned from killing the Philistine, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. And the women sang as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his ten thousands. And Saul became very angry, for this saying displeased him. He said, they have ascribed to David ten thousands, but to me they've only ascribed thousands. Now what more could he have but the kingdom? And so Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day forward. And from that time forward, you can see this insecurity in Saul develop into a boiling paranoia, where he does almost anything imaginable to get rid of David. Two times while David is playing the harp to soothe Saul, Saul takes a spear and hurls it at David, trying to kill him. When he's unsuccessful in doing that himself, he tries to get other people to kill him. First, he says to David, you want to marry my eldest daughter? Which, by the way, that was a prize that was promised to the guy who defeated Goliath. That should have been a no-brainer. Saul says, if you want to marry her, you got to go fight some more battles for me, hoping that he would die in battle. Well, What happens? David just becomes a greater and greater warrior, more renowned. And he ends up marrying his eldest daughter off to somebody else. And so he says, well, I'll marry you to my second daughter. And David says, I'm not worthy to be the king's son-in-law. By the way, I can't afford the dowry. And so Saul says, I'm not asking too much. Just 100 foreskins of Philistines. Now, I'm just going to tell you this, for those of you who don't get that. The only way you're getting a foreskin off of a Philistine is over his dead body. Okay? And if you don't understand that, ask your parents later. David comes back, not with 100 foreskins, 200 foreskins. I wouldn't have wanted to be Saul's accountant on that day. Saul's plan didn't work. He was hoping that David would die in the process, but that doesn't happen. So after the second time he tries to pin him to the wall with a spear, he sends assassins to his house to spy on him so that as soon as he comes out in the morning, they'll kill him. And David's wife, Michal, helps him to sneak out of the house. She hides the household idol in the bed, puts some hair on its head, covers it with a blanket, says, oh, Dad, sorry, David is sick. Well, Saul says, well, bring him anyway. And they go to bring him, and they find it's not actually David, but the household idol in the bed. On that occasion, Saul flees to Samuel, where God miraculously intercedes on four occasions. Saul sends three groups of messengers to apprehend David, and every time they approach Samuel and David, the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him, and they begin prophesying. And so Saul's like, fine, if you're going to do a job right, you got to do it yourself. He goes the fourth time, and the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him. He strips off all of his clothes, lays on the ground, and begins prophesying for the rest of the day. And I don't think that was the normal custom for prophesying. I think it was God's way of showing Saul, I'm humiliating you. And there seems to be a brief moment where Saul kind of comes to his senses and says, I'm not going to treat you like this, David. Come back home and be with your family. But Jonathan, David's close friend, pretty soon ascertains that Saul really hasn't changed his mind, that he's still bent on having him killed. And so David has to flee, and he becomes a fugitive. Before that happens, David and Jonathan make this covenant that whatever happens in the coming days, they will promise to deal kindly with the descendants of the other. And that will become an important factor when we look next time at the reign of David. But during that time, Saul expends most of his efforts hunting David down rather than leading his kingdom. And in the process, demonstrates not just his disregard for his job as king, but also his disregard for God. Because one of the things that he does in the process is he has 85 priests of God slain simply because David stopped by the tabernacle and got some bread and the sword of Goliath. And yet, throughout all of that, all that hostility, David refuses to do any harm to Saul. Two times, at least, David had the opportunity to kill Saul. Once in a cave. David and his men are hiding in the cave, and Saul is chasing him. And Saul has to take a potty break, and so he goes into the cave to relieve himself. And as he's relieving himself, David's men are saying, this is your opportunity, David. God's given him into your hand. And David says, no, I'm not going to strike the Lord's anointed. And on that occasion, he sneaks up close to him and cuts a little bit of his cloak off. And then after Saul leaves the cave, David comes out and says, Saul, I could have killed you, but I didn't. Here's the proof. And Saul repents and asks for David's forgiveness, only to turn around and begin to chase him again. On another occasion, Saul is camping with his commander, Abner, and the rest of his army. They're chasing David in hot pursuit. And David sneaks into Saul's camp with one of his friends. And he sees Saul, and he's standing above him. Saul's laying there on the ground with a spear stuck in the ground next to his head and a jug of water there. And his friend says, David, this is your chance. God's giving him into your hand. And David says, no, that's not my place to raise my hand against the Lord's anointed. It'll be that he'll die in battle or of old age, and when that happens, it'll be from God, but not from me. And so he takes the spear, and he takes the jug of water, and he leaves the camp, and then arouses everybody in the camp by shouting at them from across the pass with the proof that he had been in the camp, the jug and the spear. And again, he tells Saul, I could have killed you, but I didn't. Please stop trying to kill me. And again, Saul repents and tells David to come home. But at this point, David has seen that he cannot trust the instability of Saul's mind. And so we read in 1 Samuel chapter 27 that David said to himself, "Now I will perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than to escape into the land of the Philistines. Saul then will despair of searching for me anywhere in all the territory of Israel, and I'll escape from his hands." And so David literally has to flee from Israel and go and live with the enemies of Israel, the Philistines. And there he is at the head of a band of about 600 mighty men, and they go on raids in the Negev, attacking the enemies of the Jews, all the while making it look like they're conducting raids against the Jews to get on the good side of Achish, the king of the Philistines. And for a year and 4 months, David lives outside of the nation of Israel as a refugee, as a fugitive, as a wanted man in the land of the Philistines. And that brings us then to Saul's last days. Because while David is living among the Philistines decide they're going to go to war against Israel again. And Saul was trying to inquire of God, "What should I do?" But God does not answer him. In fact, we read in 1 Samuel chapter 28, verse 6, "When Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by the Urim or by the prophets." Those were the three main methods in which God would speak to his people and speak to the kings in particular. It was through the priests, through the prophets, or through dreams. And God's not speaking to Saul at all. Saul is saying, "God, what do you want me to do here?" And God is radio silence. And here's where the insecurity of Saul kicks in again. Because instead of just backing off and saying, "Well, God's not giving me any direction, I'm not going to do anything," he seeks out the assistance of a witch, a spirit medium, who is illegal in his land. He's made it illegal to practice that. And yet he goes to this woman in a disguise and asks her to conjure up the spirit of Samuel, who had died some years prior to this. She's a little bit hesitant because, you know, the king's made it illegal for me to do this. Promise me that I'm not going to be in trouble. And Saul vowed to her, verse 10, "By the Lord," he says, "as the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing." And the woman said to him, "Well, whom shall I bring up for you?" And he said, "Bring up Samuel for me." When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice. I'm going to say this. I think she was a little bit shocked that she actually conjured up the spirit of Samuel. She probably has conjured up some things in the past, but she is shocked that it actually was Samuel's spirit that appears to them here. And the woman spoke to Saul and says, "Why have you deceived me? For you are Saul." And the king said, "Don't be afraid. But what do you see?" And the woman said to Saul, "Well, I see a divine being coming up out of the earth." And he said to her, "Well, what's his form?" She said, "An old man is coming up. He's wrapped with a robe." And Saul knew that it was Samuel. And he bowed his face to the ground and did homage. And Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" And Saul answered, "I'm greatly distressed. The Philistines are waging war against me, and God has departed from me and no longer answers me, either through the prophets or by dreams. Therefore, I called you that you may make known to me what I should do." And I love Samuel's answer. "Why then do you ask me, since the Lord has departed from you and has become your adversary? Buddy, if God stopped talking to you, what makes you think I'm going to give you favorable news?" And he doesn't. He goes on and he says, "The Lord has done accordingly as he spoke through me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and has given it to your neighbor, to David. As you did not obey the Lord and did not execute his fierce wrath on Amalek, so the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will also give over Israel along with you into the hands of the Philistines. Therefore, tomorrow, you and your sons will be with me." You're going to die. "And indeed, the Lord will give over the army of Israel into the hands of the Philistines." And when you get into chapter 31, you see that just as Samuel predicted, that is exactly what happens. Verse 1 of chapter 31, "Now the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines, and and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons. And the Philistines killed Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. And the battle went heavily against Saul, and the archers hit him. And he was badly wounded by the archers. And Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and pierce me through with it. Otherwise, these uncircumcised will come and pierce me through and make sport of me." But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. So Saul took his own sword and fell on it. When his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. Thus Saul died with his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men on that day together. And when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley with those who were beyond the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the cities and fled, and the Philistines came in and lived in them. But it gets worse. As it came about on the next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head and stripped off his weapons and sent them throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. They put his weapons in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body on the wall of Bethshan. They made a display of him, a mockery of him. You remember those people at Jabesh-Gilead that early on in his reign he rescued? They never forgot that favor. And in verse 11, "Now when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and walked all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan, and they came to Jabesh and burned them there. And they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days." And thus the inglorious reign of Saul comes to a rather dismal conclusion. And that's where we'll put a peg in it in our narrative. But let me leave you with this thought as an application of these things to ourselves, because I think there's a good lesson we can learn from Saul. As I said, he was a man who was characterized by personal insecurity. He was timid. He didn't know what to do oftentimes. And when he was surrounded by scary situations, instead of looking to God, he tried to solve the problem himself. He gave in to fear and did the opposite of what he was supposed to. Do you ever feel insecure in your walk, in your life? Do you ever feel like you don't know what to do? Maybe you have personal insecurities about yourself. I'm not good enough. I could never be good enough. I'm not worth very much. And some of us suffer from that more than others, right? So we call that sometimes low self-esteem. Or maybe sometimes no self-esteem. Learn the lesson from Saul. If you are one who suffers from low self-esteem or no self-esteem, or you're constantly doubting yourself or your value or your worth, you're overcome by fears in life. I don't know what to do. I don't know where to turn. Everything is scary. Everything freaks me out. Everything makes me uncomfortable. Let me suggest to you, what you need to do is you need to turn your attention to God. Look to Him for the answers to life's difficult questions. Look to Him for the answers of life's simple questions. If you feel like you lack value or worth, look to your God who sent His Son to die for your sins. There is a sense in which none of us are worthy of the sacrifice that God made. That is, we don't deserve it. But to God, we are worth it. And I know that because of what He did in sending His Son. And so, if you struggle with insecurity in your life, don't give in to the fear. Don't give in to what everybody else is saying you should do. Instead, look to God. Samuel told Saul that if you had just trusted in God and done what God had said, God would have given you a kingdom that would have endured. But because you gave in to your fear and your insecurity, and you abandoned God, God said, I'm going to take it all away from you. And I would suggest the same is true for us. God is looking at each and every one of us, and he's saying, not a kingdom, but I'll give you a life, a spiritual life that is worth something, that is valuable. I'll give you meaning and purpose. I'll give you something to live for. And I will make sure that it will endure if you keep putting your trust in me. But if we stop putting our trust in him, start trying to do it by our own strength, or we just give up altogether, it'll fall apart. Because the thing that holds us together, guys, the thing that gives our life purpose and meaning, it's none of this stuff around us. It is our God and a relationship with him. So learn the lesson from Saul. And don't be overcome by your own insecurity.